I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. 5 million driver's licenses. That's how many get printed each year in Florida. And if you need to get a driver's license, it's pretty straightforward. With the exception of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Volusia counties, anywhere in the state you can go to a tax collector-sponsored service centre, and with the right documents and for a fee, they'll print your license on the spot. Well, now there's a proposal that could see those licenses issued by a central vendor and mailed out. The argument for centralising the system is that it's more secure and could avoid technical problems like the printing machines breaking down. But some tax collectors are sceptical. What about the two-week delay as people wait for their licence to arrive in the mail? According to MorphoTrust USA, which supplies equipment to print licences and ID cards, 25 states have centralised driver licensing. But does that mean Florida should join them? And is there any sense in changing a system which seems to work quite well, and which the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles said saves the state some $18 million a year? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. With me in the studio, Orlando Sentinel columnist and editorial writer Daryl Owens. Daryl, welcome back.
Good morning, Matthew.
Also joined by Retta Peoples, who writes for the Florida Weekly Sun. Nice to see you again, Retta.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And Jason Garcia, associate editor with Florida Trend magazine. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you. So Florida prints quite a few driver's licenses a year, whether they're brand new or renewals. Many of them are issued through the county tax collectors, and those tax collectors' offices collect a small fee from the transaction. But the significant fact of how licenses get issued here in Florida is you can get them on the spot. With a bit of a wait, of course. That could all change, though, if Florida moves to a centralized system. What do you think of the process of getting a license? Does it work? Would it be more secure, maybe less hazards and slip-ups, if it were done through a central vendor and mailed out? Would you be happy waiting 2 weeks to get your driver's license in the mail? Give us a call. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Well, Daryl Owens, you talked to 90.7's Nicole Creston about this proposal a bit earlier in the week. And aside from having to wait while the license does get mailed out, what else is different? What would be different about having a centralized system?
Well, as you pointed out in your intro, the people who are advocates of this say that it would improve efficiency and would allow them to add some additional security features to the license, which is not something that they can do now with the licenses being issued through the tax collector's office.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some concerns, though, with this idea of moving it from these local offices to a central vendor?
Well, my main concern is that in doing this, you're overriding the convenience factor, which I think is paramount here. If this is a customer service-based process, you should be able to walk into a tax collector's office as we have it now and walk out with your license the same day. Waiting 2 weeks, I think, puts undue burden on taxpayers and consumers who are using the licenses. And also, you know, we have a postal service that isn't necessarily 100% effective in delivering mail. So if it gets lost, you got to wait again and go back to the office and reapply.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have other places in the United States which have gone to a centralized system. Washington, D.C., for example, went to a central system fairly recently, a couple of years back. They say it's safer and more secure to have licenses printed off-site and mailed out. Daryl Owens, do you get the sense that there's a lot of driver license fraud going on, aside from perhaps teenagers who would like to get a license saying they're 21?
I haven't heard of anything like that. And, you know, frankly, even though other states are doing this, I don't know if Florida necessarily needs to follow suit. This is not necessarily a one-size-fits-all solution for Florida. And frankly, if Florida is looking at other states to do things and to emulate what other states are doing, we should probably invest in smart justice reforms that can save the state money and reduce our overcrowded prisons rather than looking at this solution here for a problem that doesn't exist.
Here's another question, too. What about this issue of motor voter? You go to get your license at the tax collector's office. At the same time, you can register to vote. Is there any sense that this could change if there's a centralized system? And presumably you still got to show up and present all your documents at the office. So would there be any difference there? Could could it maybe see fewer people showing up and getting a voter ID card as well?
I'm not clear on all the specifics on how that the procedure would work under this change, Matthew, so I'm going to have to decline to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Where do people, let me ask you, what do you think about that convenience factor? Do you like the idea of just being able to bowl up to your local tax collector and present your documents and wait for maybe an hour or two in a line with a bunch of other people and then get your license printed on the spot?
Absolutely. I think that's the best way. The thing that, you know, kind of sends off my radar is ID theft. What happens if that mail doesn't get to the right person? So I think that's a little bit of an issue. That's a concern. And I think that's a concern with most people as well. And then also being able to get the voter ID and register to vote right there at the tax collector's office. I think that's a good thing as well. So that may be taking it away if you get it by mail.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. We're on Intersection. We're talking about this idea of centralizing the driver licenses so that you would have to get it mailed out. Wait a couple of weeks to get your license. I think there might be a way to get it a bit faster too, but might be an added fee to that. Jason Garcia, there's a political element to everything, of course, and there's already been a little bit of political pushback to this. We've seen the likes of Adam Putnam saying, well, maybe we need to soft pedal a little bit. So what's your sense on how successful this push to centralize these licenses might be?
Well, this is one of those sort of classic legislative food fights. It's a special interest thing. So the idea is being pitched most strongly by a company called MorphoTrust USA, mm-hmm. which is the state's driver's license contractor, the company that makes the driver's licenses for the state. They've got a team of more than half a dozen lobbyists up there, and they're really pushing this. And this would obviously be very good for them. The people pushing back on this are the clerks of or the tax collectors,
right.
And you know this is they don't like the idea of losing this because this is a revenue source for them, and it's mm-hmm. it's probably I would suspect it's the single biggest driver of traffic to their offices, and probably their biggest revenue source. So you're seeing you know it's not two private interests, but it's two special interests competing over money. This is the exact sort of thing that drives everything in the agenda in Tallahassee.
And tax collectors are elected positions too. Could that be a campaign issue for some of them, maybe?
Sure, yeah. The argument they are making is as elected officials, they have more of an incentive to be responsive and make sure that this is run smoothly. You know, I guess you could make the argument that that's what the DMVs were ultimately run by elected officials too, and I don't think DMVs ever had a reputation for being the most consumer-friendly places. Mm-hmm. So whether or not the argument is true, that's definitely the argument they make.
Mm-hmm. Rita Peoples, just as a kind of taking the temperature of this, do you get the sense that this idea is going to fail, or is it going to be something that will take off an election year?
I get the sense that it'll fail. I don't think it'll go far.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a call now. We've got Melissa. Melissa is calling from Orlando. Melissa, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I don't agree with the idea simply because I've had it happen to me where I've misplaced my driver's license and mm-hmm. after searching the house for it, realizing it's really gone, I need to replace it quickly because I still need to get to work. I still need to take the kids to school. Mm-hmm. And if I had to wait 2 weeks for the driver's license to come in the mail, then that would be a problem. I'd be driving without a license.
I believe they give you a temporary license in the meantime. I mean, do you see that being an issue, though, just having something printed on paper, Melissa, or would you be able to get by with that while you waited for your actual license?
I think it would be an issue because if I need to go to the store or something and buy wine or something, you need your driver's license more than just for driving. And so what if you have a trip and you're catching a plane, you know, in that two-week time frame, you need your driver's license. Not everybody has a passport. And so there's a number of scenarios that could play out in those 2 weeks. And so I just think 2 weeks is just too long. And the convenience factor for me as a resident, it would be is an issue waiting 2 weeks.
Let me ask you this too, Melissa. Would the license be something you'd be using for, you know, maybe making a trip? I mean, is that something you'd rely on?
When I travel, yeah, I do use my driver's license to get through security, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you calling in there from Orlando. Going to go to Rick now. Rick is calling from Mount Dora. Rick, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the point that the consumer experience at the DMVs has improved drastically in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
You can make an appointment and get right in and skip the line. They'll text you when your number is called, and I think to some extent this is, you know, a corporate solution to a problem that has already been solved, at least partially.
Rick, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Well, let me ask the panel that. Daryl, what's your experience been of the consumer-friendly experience, so to speak, at the DMV?
Well, I think it mirrors what most people experience. You get in there and you're assigned a ticket, a number, and you sit and wait. But the caller is right. There have been some improvements made to try to expedite the service, and it's certainly a lot better than it used to be, but you're still going to wait a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Jason Garcia, pleasant experience for you getting your license.
I've had some pretty good run-ins at the DMV in the past, so I'm awfully sympathetic to this idea of being able to get it through the mail. I actually think that sounds like a very convenient thing, not having to go in. Mm-hmm. There obviously are issues like if you've got a trip and your license is about to expire, but people run into that with passports, right? You can't go into the office and get a passport. You're going to have to go through the mail, and that seems to work out fine for the most part. Getting it through the mail, there's pros and cons to both, but the idea of being able to bypass the DMV sounds pretty appealing to me.
Mm-hmm. Rita Peoples, there are some folks who like to do things over the counter, right? I mean, we kind of assume that everybody's online on their phones all the time and making use of all these great gadgets and apps, but that's not the way for everybody.
That's right. It's not the way for everybody, and some people like to go up to the counter and do their transactions there. I'm one of them. So you're right, the DMV definitely has changed customer service over the past few years drastically.
Mm-hmm. Going to take one more call here. We've got Jerry. Jerry, you're on the line from Lake Mary. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, guys. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Well, I have one thing to say. It ain't broke. Why are we trying to fix it and spend $18 million of taxpayers' money? It's just to put profit in a corporate pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no. I've been in Florida since 1961. I've never had a property in the license, and I don't like the idea of going through the mail either.
Jerry, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Well, some interesting conversations there. Let's just move on to something else with a little more kind of political impact here. Story about Jeb Bush. He's currently feuding with the current Republican primary frontrunner, Donald Trump. Jason Garcia, you and I have talked about Donald Trump and his what some would say it's an interesting fact that he's kind of out in front for so long. He's been there for so long, and he seems to be solidifying that lead. But anyway, this week, Trump told Breitbart News that Jeb, quote, should really set the example by speaking English while in the United States, end quote. And that was after Jeb accused Trump in Spanish of not being a real conservative. Well, let me ask you this, Jason Garcia. What is in this for Jeb Bush? Would he do well to simply ignore Trump and some of those comments that he's making? What's the strategy here?
Well, I think that was the plan at first. And like a lot of folks, including myself, they've been surprised by Trump's staying power. I don't think anyone sort of in the political class expected him to still be around and still be in this position. Especially when, I mean, you have a candidate that is entirely style and no substance, right? Everything he talks about is process rather than policy. But it's resonating. You know, you take something like this this remark about Jeb shouldn't be talking in Spanish. I mean, mm-hmm. It's sort of in one sense, it's just an unfathomable thing to say for a presidential candidate in a country where the fastest growing segment of the electorate is Hispanic Americans. But at the same time, it's something that really resonates with particularly conservative blue-collar voters, right? They're really angry that, you know, people aren't speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
And he has tapped into that base in a way that I don't think anybody foresaw. And Jeb wanted to ignore him at first, just like I think everybody else did, but it's becoming harder and harder to do. And so now they've decided to take the tact of, you know, take him on and start calling him out on stuff and hope he gets treated like a real candidate for president rather than Donald Trump or a celebrity candidate for president. Now, every other candidate so far who has tried to go after Trump has seen it sort of recoil on them, and it's ended up much worse for them than it has for Donald Trump. For Jeb, that's the risk, but the reward is he could look like that elder statesman, the guy who finally sort of, you know, brought the circus to a close.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has also pledged alliance to whoever wins the nomination. Can we expect a more civil tone between Jeb or maybe Marco Rubio and Donald Trump or whoever he sort of takes on in the next debate?
I wouldn't think so, just because, I mean, Trump's entire appeal is not being civil and not sort of playing by the sort of normal rules of a political campaign. His entire brand and appeal is built up in this idea that he says whatever's on his mind, he says it as bluntly and offensively as possible, and if you've got a problem with it, that's your problem, not his. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't expect this to have any sort of bearing on changing the tone of his campaign.
Just before we move on from this, Ritter Peoples, let me ask you this. What do you think that Trump's candidacy is doing to the Republican discourse in Florida, particularly among minority voters here in Florida?
Well, I think it's his campaign is truly, you know, built on something, like Jason said, that's really tapping into that conservative base, that way right base. I don't think he's appealing to minority voters at all. He's not appealing to me. You know, some of the things that he said has been very racist. It's been, you know, very right and right wing, rather. And, you know, honestly, I think the only advice that Jeb should be taking from Donald Trump is that of PR. Mm-hmm. You know, he's managed to capture the attention of America over and over again without placing one ad. So I think the public relations aspect of it is something they need to look into.
It's interesting that Donald Trump not too long ago was a Democrat, though, right?
That's very interesting. That's mm-hmm. very interesting. And now he's signing the pledge to be a Republican all the way through.
We'll see how long that lasts. Anyway, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, medical marijuana didn't get enough signatures to make it into the state constitution last year, but it could be back in 2016. Intersection returns, taking your calls in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital. What is it that makes life so amazing? It's each member of the community doing our part to make life better. Because here in Central Florida, we're not just citizens. We're neighbors. We're friends. We're family. We're everything that makes life amazing.
Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls. Join the conversation. You can take WMFE with you anywhere you go throughout the day. Just download the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices.
Support for 90.7 News comes from News 13, tracking storms across Central Florida right down to neighborhoods with Storm Tracker 13. Around-the-clock coverage, working to keep Central Florida families safe. News 13 is exclusively on Bright House Networks. News 13. News. Weather. Now.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Ritter Peoples from Florida Sun, Jason Garcia, Florida Trend Magazine, and Daryl Owens, Orlando Sentinel. You can join the conversation, 1-866-338-5252. After narrowly missing out on getting into the state constitution last year, Florida's medical marijuana amendment is coming, making a comeback. United for Care, the group looking to get medical marijuana on the ballot, has more than 73,000 signatures enough to trigger a review of the ballot language by the Florida Attorney General and the state Supreme Court. They still need another 600,000 signatures to get on the ballot in 2016. Let's hear from United for Care spokesman Ben Pallera.
We have collected, in reality, close to 400,000 petitions, and we're in the process of submitting those to supervisors of elections and having them verified by the state. So we're in better shape than it looks, and we're in much, much better shape than we were 2 years ago.
Well, the proposed change to the state constitution would allow a doctor to prescribe medical marijuana for debilitating medical conditions. The legislature has actually approved the use of non-euphoric medical marijuana, but its implementation has been held up in the courts. Could 2016 be the year medical marijuana makes it over the final hurdle in Florida? What does it actually mean if the amendment gets into the ballot and voters say yes? You can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Are you hoping to see the amendment back on the ballot, or do you think Florida's heading in the wrong direction with this? You can join the conversation. Ritter Peoples, polls were showing medical marijuana with pretty broad support most of last year, but it didn't really translate into a win on the ballot. Will it be different next time around?
I think so. I think now that we're entering into a presidential race, there's going to be a lot more people that are going to the polls. I also think with the petitions, that's a direct reflection of how it's going to go. With 770 petitions needed, 400,000 already collected. I think they're definitely moving in the right direction for getting it on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. Last year, local governments were too trying to get their head ahead of the game rather than kind of get their head around what it would mean as regards to where dispensaries could be sited, other zoning requirements. Do you get the sense that urgency has gone away somewhat?
No, I think the urgency is still there. And actually, there's three amendments that are being proposed to be on the ballot. So one is the United for Care. There's another one that also includes recreational marijuana as well. So we may be looking at three different options that may get on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. We had law enforcement on the show talking about their concerns about illegal street drugs. Now, medical marijuana is a different category, of course, but could it change the equation there, thinking about some of the other drugs out there?
It really could. It definitely could. I think it educating the community about medical marijuana and the difference between that and recreational and anything else that's out there is going to be key in this election.
Mm-hmm. You can join the conversation, 1-866-338-5252. I'm going to take a call now. We've got Tony. Tony, you're on the line calling from Claremont. What do you have to say about medical marijuana?
Yes, I believe that this is just an excuse to basically push the agenda of having marijuana legalized more broadly, like we're seeing in Colorado. I think the scientific use for medical marijuana is very limited, and I would be against this because I think it's just, like I said, an open door to eventually legalize marijuana on the streets for anyone and everyone.
Why would that be an issue?
Well, because I don't think cannabis and have people high walking around the streets is something that's good for our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tony, thank you so much for your call. Some concerns there that I'm sure a lot of people share. Thanks for calling. I do appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the call.
And Daryl Owens, what do you think of that caller's point there? I mean, is this a way to basically open the door to marijuana across the board?
Well, he may have a point. I mean, as Retta pointed out, there's a concurrent push to end cannabis prohibition here in Florida overall. So it certainly appears that we're heading down that road. The amendment last year that failed only failed by a small margin. They got 57.6% of the 60% vote they needed to have it pass. So there is broad support for medical marijuana. So I could see where the caller could see that it's a small jump to decriminalizing recreational marijuana as well.
If this actually happens, though, can Florida get it right? Is there a way to bring in medical marijuana and keep in line the fears of those folks who see this as a problem, whether it's law enforcement or whether it's people who are worried about maybe their kids getting involved in marijuana?
It's a good question. We certainly, if this passes, we do need to make sure that these concerns are addressed and that the medical marijuana is used for those express purposes, that it doesn't become recreational use if that other campaign fails to pass a constitutional amendment legalizing small amounts of recreational marijuana. So those concerns are valid, and our officials certainly need to address those if this particular amendment does pass this time around.
Mm-hmm. Jason Garcia, we do have something on the books already. Non-euphoric Charlotte's Web is legalized, has been signed into law, but it's still kind of tied up in bureaucratic red tape. Should medical marijuana advocates expect anything less from this broader amendment, even if it makes it all the way onto the ballot and people sign it into or vote for it come 2016?
Right. Yeah, that's one of the big wrinkles, right? Whatever they pass is going to have to be implemented by the legislature and then, you know, enacted by the executive branch. And the experience with that, the law you're referencing, they call it Charlotte's Web for the non-euphoric strain of marijuana that's legal. The experience of that sort of shows that, man, getting it passed is just the first step. The Charlotte's Web law was passed more than a year ago now, and it still has not been implemented. You know, on the flip side, they're making a pretty compelling case for why voters should do this themselves if they want it, because, you know, the Charlotte's Web was passed as in part as a way to get out in front of the campaign last time around, sort of taking away some of the medical argument by saying, look, we've got this non-euphoric stuff approved. But now, you know, people watch that and it's not out there. It's still not available. And I think that lends sort of momentum to the folks trying to get this back on the ballot.
Jason Garcia, in the likes of Rhode Island, for example, dispensaries are limited and they're licensed by the state, and growers also have to register with the state. Which other states with medical marijuana should Florida be looking to or looking at as a model to follow on this issue?
You know, I got to be honest with you. I don't know a lot about other states, how they regulate it. You're right. You're going to want to look to see other states' experience, and there will be some heavy regulation. The amendment will allow for that. But in terms of which state to emulate, I just couldn't tell you.
We also saw medical marijuana, as you said, being talked about as a political issue in the election last year. What about the presidential race? I'm wondering if this is something that you might expect to see, for example, Florida's Republican GOP candidates to bring up looking ahead to 2016.
You expect the Republican candidates, you're asking if they'll talk about this amendment? I think it's less likely they will talk about it. I think they will oppose it because it's their base. But when you look at the support it's got, it's 58% of the vote for comparison. That's 10% more of the vote than Rick Scott got. It's 3% more of the vote than Pam Bondi got, our attorney general. So it's got broad support. So I don't think you'll see them actively campaigning against it or spending a lot of time talking about it. I think you might see the Democratic candidates spending an awful lot of time talking about it because they've sort of got the majority on their side. I would not expect Republican candidates generally to get behind the amendment because it's so anathema to their base. But it's not an issue I think they're going to want to spend a lot of time discussing because they're sort of on the wrong side of it in terms of just a popular vote.
Let's just stay with the theme of the Democratic Party and what those candidates are doing for a minute. So we have a presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, dogged by an email situation there. And meanwhile, Joe Biden made what looked like a campaign stop in Miami this week. Or was it? Here's Biden talking to Miami-Dade's North College campus earlier in the week, where he asked for support for a plan for 2 years of community college, free of tuition for every student.
No longer can you get by with 12 years of high school and brawn. You're not shoveling coal in the steel mill anymore into the blast furnace. We've got to look to the new economy and what's required, not the old economy of the 21st century.
Well, Joe Biden also went to a fundraiser. He talked up the Iran nuclear inspection deal and had a long meeting with Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, chair of the Democratic National Committee. Is Biden going to make a foray into the presidential primary? We heard him speaking later in Atlanta, I believe, talking about the fact that he had to give it some serious thought. Would he do well with Central Florida voters, though? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. Jason Garcia, what did you make of that visit that Joe Biden made to South Florida, and what of his meeting with Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
Well, the meeting with Representative Wasserman Schultz, I think, speaks to just how important building some broader support for this Iran deal is for the president. Sending Joe Biden to do it in South Florida is obviously being widely interpreted as him continuing to sort of float a trial balloon for a possible presidential run. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is sort of an interesting person for him to be meeting with in that case too, because she's been a very strong Hillary Clinton supporter. So that would be an interesting conversation to have heard about the state of the race between the two of them. There were two things going on. In one sense, the president, the White House would very much like to bring a prominent Jewish Democrat like Debbie Wasserman Schultz on board for the Iran policy. And Joe Biden would almost certainly like to get some sort of sign from Debbie Wasserman Schultz that there's some room for him in the race to run against Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. He's not the only candidate in the race, though. We've got Bernie Sanders, too. The other Democrat running for president seems to be gaining some traction. Do you think he could get lost in that shuffle, though?
Bernie Sanders is a hard guy to get lost in a shuffle. He's sort of far unlike the rest of the candidates. The Democratic establishment, I think, would like to write him off as sort of a protest candidate. There may be some truth to that. He is far to the left of everyone else, but he is similar to Donald Trump. He is really tapping into a vein of anger. But on the left, there are a lot of liberal voters who are extremely upset with income inequality and what they see as the lack of real effort by mainstream candidates to address it. And that's something Bernie Sanders has been talking about for 30 years now. So he's tapped into something. I don't know that it's enough to eventually carry him over Hillary Clinton or something like that. But I think you could see him win New Hampshire or stick around a lot longer than anyone would have expected when he first announced.
Mm-hmm. Darrell Owens, I'm wondering what your thoughts are here. How well would Joe Biden do as a candidate with Florida voters, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting thing, Matthew. I think the Democrats right now are very concerned. The presumptive nominee seems to be dogged by scandal. You've got Bernie, as Jason pointed out, as kind of this protest candidate, and now we're going to throw Joe into the mix as well. But Joe Biden already has the endorsement of POTUS, and I think that with the way things are going right now, with Donald Trump saying whatever he feels, that's up Biden's alley, so he might do pretty well in Florida as well.
Mm-hmm. Callers, what do you think? Is Bernie your candidate, or if Joe Biden decides to run, would you vote for him? How do you think the media is covering Bernie Sanders? Call us 1-866-338-5252. Rita Peoples, let me ask you this. When you look at candidates for the Democratic nomination, there isn't a huge amount of diversity either geographically or in terms of age or even demographically. Is that a problem?
I think it is a problem. Some people are looking for someone who not only represents them, but they can identify with as well. And I think that we're lacking that in this presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm. That said, though, the only black candidate in the race so far on the Republican side, Ben Carson, he's surging in polls in Iowa. What's he doing right?
You know what? I don't know what he's doing right, but I know that he's not making any traction with anybody I know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that he's still in the race, and I'll see how long that lasts.
I think what he's doing right is not being a traditional candidate, right? Donald Trump and Ben Carson both sort of represent the exact opposite of a Jeb Bush or a Hillary Clinton, someone that doesn't come from politics. They've got a completely different background, mm-hmm. and they're someone that this segment of angry voters will turn to as they look for someone that they think can actually – will actually do something different, you know?
Yeah.
But it also speaks to Republican hypocrisy too, I think, Jason, because the two candidates who are gaining the most traction are two candidates who are inexperienced politically. And that was one of the major things that Republicans attacked Barack Obama for when he was running for president.
Right.
Although if you compare Barack Obama, he was a senator. He had a lot of organizing ability from earlier in his career. So as far as somebody who hasn't run for office at all versus somebody who's been a senator, there's quite a difference.
Right. That's my point exactly. At least mm-hmm. Barack Obama had political experience, and yet they still attacked him for not being experienced enough.
Well, let's go to the phones now. I'm going to go to Fanchon. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly there. You're calling from UCF. Bernie or Joe, what's your call there?
I absolutely, being a young voter, am heavily leaning toward Bernie Sanders. And I see a large push from my fellow students and coworkers and everybody around this area towards Bernie, because a lot of people are tired of the Bush name. They're tired of, you know, the same names being in the offices. And with Bernie Sanders, you have the same bluntness that Trump brings. However, you don't have the ignorance that he brings, and I feel like that really resonates with younger voters.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your call, Fanchon. I do appreciate it. We're going to go to another call now on this. We've got Richard. Richard, you're on the line from Orlando. What's on your mind?
Hey there. I was calling in for some support for Bernie Sanders as well. You know, I feel like he doesn't get a lot of really in-depth representation in the media. It's gotten a lot better than it was early on into his campaign. A lot of people wrote him off.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a very consistent record over the last 30 years of really keeping his word. He's really shown that he wants to serve the people, which is something that, you know, is a lot of times comes off as buzzword and rhetoric. But I feel that there's something genuine in him as a candidate. I worry sometimes that, you know, he's always talked about as, you know the distant second place to Hillary Clinton, and yet, you know, he's making a lot of stride. I feel that if the media gave him a little more credit, it would get him over that hump that he is facing right now with, you know, just being this sort of, far out left field.
Mm-hmm. It is still pretty early days, though, so there's some time to run yet in the campaign, I guess. Do you expect to see him down in Florida anytime soon?
I don't even know. You know, I've been so busy in my own personal life. Is he coming down to Florida? I don't know.
We'll see, I guess. Well, thank you so much for your call, Richard. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Your thoughts there, Ritter. It seems like Bernie Sanders has got a couple of young voters on his side, at least. What is it about somebody who's been in politics for a long, 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 long time who's kind of able to connect with these younger voters? I find that interesting.
That's very interesting. I think young people are getting it right. You know, our youth, they're definitely getting more politically active. And I think if they support a candidate like Bernie Sanders, that, you know, we should support them if they find him genuine. I think that's excellent. It'll get them to the polls.
Mm-hmm. We do have quite a few young candidates and diverse candidates, too, on the Republican side as well. That's kind of another thing to keep in mind.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah, they've got some youth on their side as well. You know, the Republicans have, I think, the whole gamut. You know, they've got everybody in the race, so they can be very diverse.
We haven't heard a whole lot, Jason Garcia, from the likes of Marco Rubio lately. He's been fairly quiet. Where's he kind of sitting in the polls at the moment, and could he kind of gain some steam down the track, do you think?
Yeah, he certainly could. He's sort of sitting there in the sort of mid single digits, along with a whole bunch of other folks. I think part of what they're banking on is sort of this churn. If we learned anything from the last primary season, is that there's going to be this churn where candidates rise briefly to the top and then they'll turn down. And so he's trying to ride that out. What I think his strategy is to wait for moments where lots of people are paying attention, like debates, where he tends to excel, and he'll sort of shine in those moments. That's what he's hoping anyway. And he's in actually a pretty strong position. He shows up in a lot of polls as everyone's sort of second favorite candidate, right? And when nobody can agree on their first favorite, that's a pretty good position to be in. So I think he will at least have one roll through – one rise to the top, whether or not it's timed right to be the guy or not. I definitely don't think we've heard the last of them.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call now. This is Liz. Liz, you're on the line from Orlando. What's your thought here? You've got something to say about Ben Carson.
Yeah, I was listening to the callers about young people really supporting Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way that the question was phrased kind of alienated Republican voters in just, like, there are other candidates, and I think that Ben Carson is not one to be totally, like, pushed away to the side so right now. Mm-hmm. Someone who's coming up on Donald Trump is a really big deal. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. I can say that very openly.
Right.
But I think that negating his power right now, kind of laughing when you speak about him, is just making the supporters of him feel like, well, why won't you take him seriously? And I think that's a really big issue.
So you're a supporter of Ben Carson?
Right now, I don't have a support because the voting is more than a year away. Right now, Ben Carson is my current favorite, but who knows? We still have so much time.
Mm-hmm.
So much can happen. Once we find out who wins in Iowa and who wins in New Hampshire, by the time we vote in Florida, half these people mm-hmm. won't be on our ticket.
What do you think of the two Florida candidates there, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio? What are your thoughts on those two?
I'm a big fan of Jeb Bush. He was originally my favorite when this whole campaign started.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that sometimes he does come across as out of touch and a little bit outdated. I appreciate his ability to support Hispanic voters. I think that he does have that kind of pull just in that he speaks Spanish and he does have different views on immigration than most Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that being a Bush is just really going to hurt him. That's the only issue that I have with him is I don't think he can win because his last name is Bush.
Mm-hmm. Do you have the same thoughts about Hillary Clinton then? Could the name be a deficit to her?
I think that Hillary Clinton will appeal to a lot of Democratic voters because she's a woman and we don't really are. Carly Fiorina in the Republican race is not as out yet. You know, she hasn't gotten
right.
She wasn't at the top 10 of the debate. But I think that Hillary Clinton's emails, like if things start to come out with that is going to be a really big issue for her in the race.
Mm-hmm. I do believe we are going to see Carly Fiorina in the next debate, though, on CNN. So it'll be interesting to see how that debate shakes out. Well, Liz, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about Panthers. We're going to leave politics and talk about Panthers. Of course, there's a bit of politics involved in that as well, but maybe not so much. There's a new plan to talk about how Panthers are dealt with in Florida and maybe turn some of the management of those Panthers, those endangered animals, over to the federal government. You can call in and share us your thoughts on Panthers in Florida when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from FPL. FPL's next-generation energy centers bring clean solar energy to homes and businesses across the state. More information about FPL's commitment to clean solar energy is available online at fpl.com.
I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls. Join the conversation. You can also find more from the Intersection team on our website, WMFE.org, and on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from UCF College of Graduate Studies, announcing UCF Grad Fair September 15th from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. Attendees will receive information about enrolling in graduate school at UCF and taking the next step toward career advancement. Details at graduate.ucf.edu.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Jason Garcia, Florida Trend Magazine, Rita Peoples, Florida Sun, and Daryl Owens from the Orlando Sentinel. Well, the state's considering changes on how it manages its panther populations, and there's been a mixed reaction to it. New guidelines call for greater federal involvement and the development of more conservation lands, as the panther population could expand beyond its primary habitat in South Florida. The proposed changes follow more reported human interactions with the panthers. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission heard from the public in Fort Lauderdale this week. Here's Cliff Coleman. He manages Black Boar Ranch, which is a South Florida shooting preserve.
It went from seeing them once a year, now it's then it went to, you know, once a month or something like that. We can probably see a cat weekly, and I can get one on a game camera or see a track every night of the week.
But Kate McFall of the Humane Society said the guidelines weaken protections for panthers. Let's hear from her.
Achieving these goals aimed at preventing panther extinction, particularly establishing additional breeding populations in the Southeast, may be more difficult in today's world, given the extent of habitat loss. But just because it's difficult doesn't mean we should throw in the towel on long-term recovery.
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has come under fire for its proposal to manage the black bear population, but what about those panthers? Is more federal involvement the way to go? And have you seen a panther in the wild? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Rita Peoples, how much does the average city-dwelling Floridian care and know about panthers, and how much resources should go towards their protection?
I don't think we know very much about, you know, exactly what's going on with all of this. But I think we need to find, if there's going to be federal involvement, we need to find another way as opposed to hunting the animals.
Well, let's just be clear that if we're talking about black bears, hunting is a way to manage the species. I don't think there's any plans at this stage to hunt panthers. The numbers are pretty small, but there are some changes afoot for how the population is managed. And they do roam pretty far. I mean, have you seen a panther ever?
Never. Mm-hmm. Ever. And don't look forward to it.
Yeah. Daryl Owens, more interactions with humans could mean the population of panthers is increasing. Is that a good sign for the animal?
Well, you know, it seems to be a conflicting sign. I mean, in 2014, Florida had a record number of Florida panthers dying. There were 30 cats that died, which was a 50% increase from 2013. So, you know, you have conservationists will point out that their numbers are still small and they're getting smaller because of these deaths. And when we talk about human-panther interaction, a lot of these interactions are panthers hitting the Chevrolets and Fords on the highway. So I'm not real sure that the idea that some are proposing of removing panthers from the federal endangered species list as well, which would remove some of these protections that the animals have, is a good idea because I'm still not sure that their numbers are sufficient enough to warrant that.
Is it kind of inevitable, though, as the population increases, of the human population increases in Florida, that we're going to see more of these interactions, so to speak, between whether it's panthers, whether it's bears, whether it's, you know, other wild animals and people?
Well, that's absolutely correct. And that's what the problem is. These increased human-animal interactions are being caused by the encroachment of development. It's not the animals' fault that, you know, their habitat space is shrinking and our mansions are growing, but the animals are the ones who are going to pay the price.
Mm-hmm. Jason Garcia, I do see quite a few panther license plates out there, so people care enough to spend a little bit of extra money to help support wildlife and panthers particularly. But what about voters? Could panthers be an election issue?
Oh, of course they could. In fact, this speaks to directly to one of the sort of the biggest policy debates going in Florida right now. You probably know that last year voters approved Amendment 1, steering more money into environmental conservation land buying. In fact, it was the most popular thing on the ballot. It got more votes than any single politician in Florida. Mm-hmm. And yet it has not been implemented, in part because there's a big fight right now in the legislature between environmentalists who want to buy more land and legislators who feel like the state already has enough land in conservation and wants to do more maintenance of that land. But what this speaks to is the importance of getting land into conservation and making sure it doesn't get developed so you've got more habitat for these animals to spread out into without interacting with humans, without, you know, killing calves on ranches or, mm-hmm. or crossing roads and stuff. So, yes, I think voters definitely care about this sort of thing. And a panther is a very sort of vivid symbol for a movement like this. And I think it might be – this debate might actually sort of infuse momentum into the idea of getting to use that Amendment 1 money for actual land buying.
Would people be more interested if they knew it was connected to an animal rather than just preserving a patch of wildlife?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that's true. Anytime you can attach a sort of a vivid symbol to a movement, it helps. Even the black bear hunt, I think you will see that inform the Amendment 1 debate when it picks up again. You're starting to see they make a very compelling case as to why you need land, which will start putting pressure on folks to actually spend this money on buying land rather than just retrofitting pipes or cleaning runoff and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move from wildlife to guns and talk about an Apopka gun maker. He's taking orders for an assault rifle designed, quote, not to be used by Muslim terrorists. It has the etchings of a Bible scripture and a symbol from the Christian Crusades on it. Manufacturer Spikes Tactical calls the $1,400 gun the Crusader. Well, Iraq veteran and gun designer Ben Thomas calls the rifle a reflection of reality. He says Muslim terrorists are being trained overseas with American guns.
There's nothing actually stopping a white supremacist from getting their hands on that gun.
I apologize. That's the wrong bite there. Here's what Ben Thomas actually says. He says, whenever something's uncomfortable, we label it bigoted, insensitive, and we take it off the discussion table. We just won't talk about it. He says, when he says Muslim terrorists, he's seen Muslim terrorists with his own eyes, and he did 10 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, he says the Crusader isn't aimed at peaceful Muslims. Spikes Tactical plans to pre-make 350 Crusader assault rifles, but the gun is drawing fire from the Council on American-Islamic Relations, rather. And spokesman Ali Kanaz says there's nothing actually stopping a white supremacist from getting their hands on the gun and from a potential mass shooter from getting their hands on the gun. He says it's, quote, another shameful marketing ploy intending to profit from the promotion of hatred and violence, end quote. Well, does this seem like a publicity stunt, or does Ben Thomas actually have a point? Is he forcing us to confront something that we don't really like to talk about? Rita, are you surprised that a gun factory would inscribe Bible verses on the side of a rifle?
I am. I'm very surprised at that. I'm not even sure what to make of it. I don't even know how to comment on it. I'm not sure what to make of that either way.
Mm-hmm. Daryl, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm not surprised that the Bible verses were inscribed on the gun. I mean, we've got pearl-handled Colt 45s. We love our guns in America, and we try to ceremonialize them in many ways. But to the point, I think the gun manufacturer makes an excellent point. I mean, these guns are not aimed at peace-loving, law-abiding Muslims. They're out there to be a deterrent to Muslim terrorists. And, mm-hmm. you know, I see these kind of akin to the biometric smart guns, the guns that do not fire without your fingerprint signature. You're adding a scripture biometric to these guns.
Mm-hmm. Do you think – I mean, does it seem like a publicity stunt, though? Is that one way to read it?
Oh, sure. Absolutely, it's a publicity stunt. But that doesn't mean that the intent that the manufacturer has in mind for the gun isn't a valid one.
Mm-hmm. And finally, let's just talk about Emirates for a minute and tourism. This week, an A340 double-decker jumbo jet airliner touched down in Orlando. The Emirates jet was the first of a daily service by the major airline, and that opens up a direct link with the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. Of course, we already have those links, but a direct flight is quite a game-changer. Jason Garcia, Orlando leaders like to talk about the city as, quote, world-class. Does this new flight go some way towards bolstering that?
Oh, yeah. This is sort of hugely important for the city. One of the challenges in Orlando historically has been you can sort of get anywhere in the country domestically on a flight direct, but it's very hard to get international from Orlando aside from a handful of core markets like England, now Brazil and stuff like that. But what this flight does is it gives Orlando a direct connection into one of the biggest global hubs in the world. Mm-hmm. So suddenly now you're a one-stop flight away from a whole bunch of markets in Asia that were previously two or three stops away. It's enormously important to have flights to these major hubs. This is probably the biggest flight Orlando has added since Lufthansa started flying to Orlando from Frankfurt, which is its global hub.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, Darrell Owens, do you see this kind of giving an extra boost to the airport's plan to try and expand that airport? And they do have some pretty big plans afoot there.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful booster shot for that. The Orlando Airport Authority officials see the growth that's coming here, and they see that one of the main drivers is going to be international travelers, and this certainly can only help their cause.
Well, you've been listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We've been joined by Darrell Owens. He's an editorial writer and columnist with The Sentinel. Thanks for coming in, Darrell.
Enjoyed it, Matthew. Thank you.
And Retta Peoples, columnist with The Florida Sun. Thank you so much, Retta.
Thank you, Matthew.
And Jason Garcia, associate editor with Florida Trend Magazine. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thanks very much.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance for this week's show from Nicole Creston, Abe Abaraya, and Alex Gasparini. Join us on Intersection next Tuesday morning at 9. We'll be talking about Florida's economy and jobs of the future. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.